Hi, everybody. It's the Week in the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we look back at the previous week in football and or soccer and tackle the things that we thought were interesting. I'm Tom Rennie. Alongside me, as ever, is MLS legend, top broadcaster and bionic man, Dunny Brian Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm good, Rennie. The hip has been tested going through airline security, and as expected, ding, 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 ding. Sir, you need to take anything out of your pockets. Think about taking your shoes off. And I got to use the old, nope, I got a new hip. We do know that now I have to spend just an extra few minutes doing the hands up, take a deep breath, don't move, check my junk, and make sure that I'm all clear going through. But more importantly, how was the regrettable stag party at the weekend hanging out over in Lisbon?
Super cool, man. I would definitely recommend Lisbon. Not that I saw a great deal of it. There was wonderful views from the many, many rooftop bars that I went to. I did meet a lot of Americans. There was mainly Irish there, which I never quite got a handle on. But there was a lot of Americans, many of whom I was like, oh, do you like football? And they were like, oh, yeah, we love. And they said something about the Seahawks or some Sorry, Tim. And I was like, no, soccer. You like soccer? Lionel Messi, you like soccer? And they all said no. So either A, they didn't want to talk to me, or B, we're not having the crossover success that I'm hoping for here. So if you're listening, anyone I met in Lisbon this weekend and said, listen to the podcast Week in the Tackle, and you're listening to it because I recommended it, because, you know, middle-aged, bored English man shouting at you whilst drunk in rooftop bar is a great pathway into listening to our podcast. Hi. Thanks for listening to me. Do get in touch on our various social medias and let us know why you did this. But it was good. The only issue with Lisbon, though, is that it's... I had a great time on the Saturday night. We didn't go to Sporting Lisbon against Benfica, but we're in the Barrio Alto on the Saturday night. And around about midnight, 1 a.m, loads of fans from like the local derby descended onto the area, which was quite cool. Sporting 1-2-1. Ruben Amorim, their manager, may well be the next Liverpool manager. And I did ask a lot of questions about the two teams, the city, the football culture, Ruben Amorim. The trouble is, I was so fucking sorry, Tim, that I can't remember a single thing they told me to use in the program. So there you go. That was the trip. No. I do want to talk about a few things today. I want to talk to you about data analysis and how much we should be taking it as a guide to what is going to happen, or it's part of the conversation to lead us to what might happen. I want to talk a bit maybe about Everton's points deduction, which, you know, we're going to move away from profitability and sustainability because it's just not going to be fit for purpose moving forward. And if Everton's there, if no one goes down this season without a points deduction, then I think maybe we don't do this again because that'll be a huge let off. And we've got some heroes and villains of the last week as well, including a new detective agency playing in goal in the Premier League. So we'll talk about that. but let's start with the big game of the weekend, which was the 2-2 draw between Man United and Liverpool, Dunny. A game where Liverpool had a lot of the ball, a lot of the chances. Jurgen Klopp did his thing where it was like, hey, I think it was our friend Guy Mowbray asking the questions. And they said to Jurgen Klopp, both teams disappointed with the result, Jürgen. I think maybe you maybe a little bit more. And he was like, wow, they're disappointed with the result, huh? Wow. Well, okay, there you go, Manchester United, you know, and moved on. He's Dutch. And I mean, it was a massive disappointment for Liverpool, right? I mean, it goes to a narrative of the last couple of shows we've done in these big games, this really interesting title race, Europe's most interesting title race, that Arsenal went into Man City and we didn't quite agree on the gravitas of that result, Arsenal not winning it. The stats people, the data miners, the folks at Opta had Liverpool as title favourites after last week because of the way the results went. This week it swung again. They now make Man City favourites to be champions. Yeah. What do you make to results in big games with 7 weeks to go causing such changes in a model which is supposed to give us a likely scenario, and that likely scenario is changing on one result?
Yeah, well, I have my own issues with data because I think data certainly tells a big piece of the puzzle when with regards to what it looks like. And we should certainly take that into account. That being said, I'm not sure how data predicts Kwanzaa hitting a blind ball back across the face of Virgil van Dijk with Bruno Fernandes hitting up and hitting a lawn dart with spinning the ball off the laces, just out of the reach of Kelleher. I'm not sure how we account for Kobbie Mainoo spinning and pivoting on a single touch and picking out the far post in the upper corner. I'm certainly not sure how we kind of digest an Aaron Wan-Bissaka naive challenge, maybe the best tackler in the Premier League, on Harvey Elliott, who goes down somewhat easily, but still given the opportunity to go down easily. All of those things can be true at real time. And I think now we're still trying to digest strength of schedule, position of players and position of teams, and home, is it away? Are they coming off Champions League? Are they coming off Europa League? All of these things. So I get it. I think the beauty in all of this is we kind of try to take as much of this information and try to make it as transparent in terms of an opinion, is the reality is we don't know. And this is the beauty of finally having three teams competing for the top of the Premier League title race. These are incredible moments. It's going to be an incredible run-up. And now we just wait to see which teams, quote-unquote, slip up. Because if we're just going by the style of the way the games are played, Liverpool certainly much more fun to watch. Manchester United, certainly a transition team that can be lethal. But checking my notes, yes, 87 shots in the three matches against Liverpool that Manchester United conceded. And it was a 0-0 draw at Anfield, a 4-3 win in the FA Cup, and a 2-2 draw at home. But if you're a neutral, I think you're more excited by the way that Liverpool plays their football. If you're a Manchester United fan, you're going like this. Whew, man, those derbies still mean something. At least we can show up for a couple of big games.
On the stat of the shots faced, to take us a little bit sideways on it,
yeah,
a lot has been made of how many shots Man United have faced this season. And there was a list published maybe last week sometime of the top 10 teams to have conceded the most amount of shots in European football. Man United were first, I think West Ham were third. And on the other end of the spectrum, I think Bayer Leverkusen were the lowest amount of shots faced, or something like that. It was very close to Leverkusen being the best. What do we read into that? Why does that matter? Why is that an interesting data point, do you think, that a team faces a lot of shots?
Well, first and foremost, I think we have to state the obvious, which is this back four against Liverpool was the 27th different combination. That for me is mind-boggling. So there's an understandable, justifiable number that in terms of the backline combinations, which says, obviously, the amount of injuries and suspensions have been devastating for Erik ten Hag. But then again, when you're talking about those numbers and shots faced, then how do you have any element of control with regards to the way you play, which is something that Erik ten Hag is constantly telling us outside of the game away against Brentford. What it suggests is that the game model lacks an identity. That's the most simple. Now, is it justifiable? Why? Because of the injuries that the team has suffered, yes. But at the same time, you look at Liverpool, you look at Newcastle, you look at Brighton, there's someone else that's got to be Chelsea, that all were in that same conversation with regards to players lost, players games lost over the course of the season. But again, it's the lack of inspirational objectivity when it comes to Erik ten Hag, which every game we should have taken our chances. We've had five goals to score. We were in complete control. Somehow it never aligns with what we're seeing visually. So yeah, they're a sieve. They are so easy to play through. It's a lack of a concentrated press. Erik ten Hag had his quotes this week talking about he knows how they play. He doesn't care about what anyone says if they don't see how he plays. It's an identifiable style of play. The only identifiable style is a very direct into the channels, find Garnacho, find Marcus Rashford, and try to hit in transition. Outside of that, I think we're all scratching our heads. But at the end of the day, they're not a Champions League top four finisher, and we're talking about everybody else who is, including Aston Villa and Tottenham Hotspur. But again, I go back to style, substance, identity. There's three very clear leaders in that, and that right now is going to be Arsenal, Man City, and Liverpool, not necessarily in that order.
And going back to that title race, you know, last week we had a conversation about the fact that Arsenal didn't win at Man City, and there are plenty of people, and I can still be convinced, I'm not currently, and maybe at the end of the season, this is the only way to prove this point or otherwise, but I think they had to win that game. And that's not to say they still can't be champions. They're still a third favourite, according to all analyses. But they could still win the league. They might still be there, and they're going to get plus 90 points. That's all fantastic. They might still win the Champions League. They're like third or fourth favourites. Bookie's third. And then the data says fourth. However, they did not win that game. That's another game that Man City did not lose. That's another huge advantage they could have had, which they didn't get. And we go to this weekend. And I just thought going into it, if Liverpool win against this incredibly average Manchester United, who have got not so much to play for right now, I still think they'll finish in the top six, which means, you know, West Ham, Chelsea, Brighton, whoever it is chasing them down won't catch them because they're all just as inconsistent. But with minimal to play for Man United, they still couldn't beat them. And I just sort of felt like they had to win that game because the rival you're up against is Manchester City, and them dropping points is so difficult to see in the kind of April-May window. They had to win it. And I just wonder whether, if City are champions this year, whether these two weekends will be the reason, because Liverpool, for whatever reason, could not get over the line in that game. And did that pressure, did that knowledge, did that, you know, you see it a lot, don't you, with teams out the front suddenly crumble in all sports all the time. The favourites tag switching to them for the first time this season, the knowledge that a win in every game saw them as champions, did that have an impact this weekend, as I felt it did to a lesser degree the previous weekend?
I think ultimately we're going to be talking about two phases of play. We're going to be talking about which teams were wasteful in front of goal, although all three teams are capable of scoring multiple goals every single match. And then ultimately what mistakes were made, whether individually or collective, with regards to giving up goals. Right now, Arsenal looks the stingiest with regards to keeping the ball out of the back of their net. We saw a really loose defensive performance at Crystal Palace for Man City, even though they're capable of scoring four goals. And right now, having Kevin De Bruyne back and still being able to rest a Phil Foden, lean in a couple of young players like Rico Lewis and Oscar Bob, you've got that depth and proof of concept. And then obviously Liverpool, they still scored two goals. And again, Kwanzaa, an unmistakable pass to make across when it's a blind ball, and give credit to Bruno for jumping the shark. There's still so much depth in that roster that can create offensive scoring opportunities, especially with all three of these teams so good in simple possession and, forcing and chasing. At the end of the day, it's less, I think Man United still has a role to play potentially in the run-up with a couple of these matchups still on hand in particular, who do they play? They've got Arsenal.
Tottenham is City game.
Arsenal at United. And then what was the other one? No, that was the only one. And then the rest is, Chelsea, Aston Villa, Spurs, Wolves, West Ham, Brighton all have a role to say with these top three teams. So when everyone says there's an outright, I don't believe them. Maybe someone here or there can lean towards someone saying they have a better opportunity. But yeah, I'm in agreement. I think we are going to continue to have this conversation of what these Opta stats say, who's the favorite. And then we're going to try to tear them apart and tell everybody why they're not the favorite.
Listen, I want to talk to you about one other thing on the weekend and then move us on a bit. And that is about young players and the over-egging of young players. Because I had a conversation during the England games recently with a few friends of ours on SiriusXM FC about Kobbie Mainoo, right? Now, I am not, before anyone starts having a go at me, saying Kobbie Mainoo is not good. He is obviously good. And the goal at the weekend, the Makeda-esque effort with the same sponsor in the background, 15, whatever it is, years later, super cool, looks like a really good player. And I want him to be great because he's English and that'd be fantastic, right? However, right
now...
You're
just a hater.
Well, whatever. That's fucking rubbish, but whatever. Sorry, Tim. But like in the end, he's played 30 senior games, scored a couple of great goals. That was his first ever Manchester United goal. And the conversation for me would be...
At Old Trafford.
Yeah, exactly. At Old Trafford. And it's like, he's not a shoe-in for the Euros. And my comparison would be, if you're in a nation that's trying to win that competition... And you're trying to get into a team with Jude Bellingham and Declan Rice, Kobbie Mainoo, having played 30 games in his life in senior football, he doesn't belong in that conversation, and we shouldn't put that pressure on him. Because I think that's just not... I think lots of other players can do what Mainoo can do and has done, and they've played 300 or 400 games in a bunch of major tournaments, right? So that's my argument in short. And the other side of the argument is, oh my days, this boy's sick though, boy. What the hell? Why is it amazing? And all this kind of like rubbish. Like, oh, generational talent. Look at this guy. It's a generational talent though. So he's played 15 games. Did you think Federico Maqueda was a generational talent? Like, calm down, right? And I also read following the game the weekend, right? So bearing in mind that Gerald Quansah playing in League One last year. So for him to now be playing in the Premier League in a huge game like this, great achievement. Again, looks a good player. Wish him very well, all that sort of stuff. But I read some piece comparing him to Roy Keane. Like, this is a performance from a young player I've not seen since, you know, such and such played against Juventus in 94, whatever the article was, right? But loads, like, he's amazing. Yeah. His diabolical pass set up Bruno Fernandes' goal. He was perfectly fine. That happens to anybody. But it just struck me a bit, Danny, and I wanted to get your view on it. The over-egging of these young players. Why can a young player not just be, looks a good young player, playing beyond his years, really wish them well, instead of it being like, oh, a 17-year-old had five good players, generational, elite of the elite player who's going to go on to redefine football for the next 30 years. Like, why do we do that? Why are people doing that? And is it not better just to like let them get to 100 games before we find out who they are?
Well, welcome to being an American soccer fan, Tom Rennie. Well, welcome. You've finally jumped the shark and you've entered the American chat. We call it soccer. Ding, 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 ding. I mean, listen, obviously I'm a Man United fan. So Kobbie Mainoo has been, alongside Garnacho, the two brightest spots of the season in an otherwise really fucking frustrating year. Sorry, Tim. And Kwambala, I thought, was really good as well at the weekend. Showed a lot of potential. I think with regards to Kobbie Mainoo and going to the Euros, he's obviously ahead of a guy like Calvin Phillips. Should he be ahead of a guy like Jordan Henderson in the conversation? Should he just be a player for experience sake goes to that tournament? I would argue absolutely, but that's just me. I think his level of performance and consistency has changed maybe the narrative. And it's funny because when you listen to the Carragers and you listen to the Nevilles and this constant conversation about who clubs need to buy and how much they need to spend, a part of this is seeing a young player being developed in real time. Now, whether that's a product of Erik ten Hag or that's just a product of the player and taking advantage of the opportunity in the midfield, which you've bought Christian Eriksen, you've bought Casemiro, you've bought Mason Mount, and this kid has proven that he's kind of the perfect foil alongside whoever you put next to him. Well, that says something. But I think this is really the year, and this might be a byproduct of the last 4 years, including 2020, that we're seeing a lot of injuries. And this idea of games that matter and international duty and short recovery time and quick turnaround times with players getting 2 weeks of an off-season break and going right back to full training. Maybe that's part of this conversation with all the injuries. When you're talking about Brighton, short turnaround, crazy season, maybe the squad's not built for it. Newcastle United, incredible success, Champions League qualification, maybe their squad's not built for it. Chelsea, maybe the infrastructure and the medical staff, and the training not built for it. With what were we talking about celebratory for the Carabao Cup for Liverpool? We were talking about all the kids coming on in the final moments for Liverpool, outclassing, outperforming Chelsea in that moment. I just think maybe this is the year of the kids. And that's okay. To your point, let's just not hype them up too much. Let's not blow them up too much. So then we're breaking these kids down when they're not performing. Because, I mean, look at Jadon Sancho. You know, two summers ago, Euros final, everything's amazing, world's at the fingertips, and then we got to think about not just performance, but we also have to think about the mental health of the player.
And Evan Ferguson's another point to build on yours as well. One minute he's going £50 million to Man United this summer, and the next he's injured consistently, and when fit, Danny Welbeck is starting in front of him because he's not scoring goals and not playing well.
Jeffers, remember that name?
I mean, I do. Franny went to Arsenal, didn't he, from Everton when he was like 18, 19.
What was his name? David, the kid who was at Spurs?
David Bentley, retired at 28, I think, in the end. Yeah. I saw him at a festival a few years afterwards. No regrets. Yeah, that's exactly what was happening. It was tub thumping in there. I can't remember the full conversation. He seemed nice enough. He was retired, though, so, you know, do what you want. Anyway, it just annoys me a little bit. And Kobbie Mainoo, by the way, to the Euros as experience. Yeah, squad number 27. Make the tee. That's still absolutely makes fine. It. Yeah. You should do that. But not the 26 that might play. Anyway, listen, I want to move us on to Everton briefly, because I do think it's really interesting that they've had a further 2 points deducted from their total this season. And just, you know, briefly for me on Everton, as on a macro level here, it's obviously been a disastrous time. And Fahad Moshiri's running of the club has been very poor. His understanding of the finances of English football was very poor. He lost Alisha Usmanov's money when the Ukraine-Russia war began, the illegal invasion of Ukraine by Russia for absolutely no bloody reason. So a lot happened to them that was not within their control. But what's interesting to me is that they had the 10 reduced to 6. They've now had a further 2, which they're appealing again, which seems a bit strange considering they did it. And this is less than the Premier League wanted them to be deducted. You know, if they stay up this year, this conversation will just disappear. It disappears because they shouldn't, moving forward, receive any further punishments for financial mismanagement. These are the two financial books they were massively worried about. I know there's debate about the money that is allowed to go into the stadium or otherwise, and that's part of the appeal process. But it feels to me that don't appeal it. Stay up this season. Realize how fortunate you have been to get these points deductions across 2 years, two financial years, happening in the same season in a year where the worst three ever to come up together have come up together. And you add that then to something Everton, I think, have needed for a long, long time, and that is hope. To be able to grab onto some hope from somewhere. And, you know, when my team, when West Ham were definitely going to go down in the near future, the Icelandic banking crisis had happened, our owner had gone bankrupt, we were owned by creditors, and we hired a manager in Avram Grant who was either asleep or useless. And those were his two speeds. And they went down bottom of the league, having let this idiot, this complete buffoon, stay in charge for the entirety of the season. You know, and you had to wake him up for games. But they felt they were going to go down for a long time. But the promotion season, the winning of the 2012 playoff under Sam Allardyce, was incredible, and it gave the club this huge boost going to the next 2, 3, 4 seasons. A similar thing happened to Villa as well. Then they had a takeover and all that. I wondered previously to this season if the best thing to happen to Everton would be relegation, an end to this constant circling the plug hole they've done, and a promotion season, being in the right half of the table, all of that might change the club's kind of ethos. But now I feel like staying up this season and not having these charges hanging over them and then getting taken over and then going to this new incredible stadium.
Yeah.
It sort of feels like it's now set up to be, for years, Everton finished 17th has felt like, oh, they've won something. This year, Danny, it feels like they really are going to win something, and it's going to be tough. I think they will stay up with the two deductions. And if that happens, imagine being able to close the book on this and not have to worry about it anymore going into a new season. Could be huge.
Yeah, no, I'm buying what you're selling because I agree with you 100%. What I hate, I despise the fact that Everton, while being held accountable for understanding that they've broken the rules, are being punished on two separate occasions. And I know the 10-point deduction getting knocked down to 6, but then to add these extra 2, I don't like the idea that you can get sucker punched twice. I feel like if you're going to do it and you're going to say, okay, here's one season, here's two seasons, like, why are you doing it in the same year, in the same category of 2024? Why was this not done for the 2021-2022 season last season? It's beneficial. You're correct. I think the one thing also to keep in mind for Sean Dyche and company is that his players have already dealt with this. So it's almost like we pull up our shorts a little bit higher. We just get to work. You know, we've given ourselves a fighter's punch. We know we would have been on 35 points. So let's dig in. Let's get to it. We know we have. And I think the quality of the squad, I would agree with you, is absolutely there to stay up. Now, Moshiri asking for patience, 777, going into the new stadium. I still think that the Premier League, with this rule, profit and sustainability, if you are going to adjust this, the easiest adjustment would be to make it midnight Friday or Saturday morning to the start of the Premier League season. I think that's where you can make it justifiable for all involved to maximize player sales. That puts even more onus and responsibility for the clubs to get their business done and do it the right way, and capitalize on the value of a player as opposed to try to sell them as of May 31st or whenever, May 26th, whenever the season number ends. If you are going to go to a luxury tax format, then how are you going to then redistribute that money? Should it be redistributed into the Championship and League One as opposed to just the rest of the teams in the Premier League? And then ultimately, I think you have to have a spending base where you say, here is the floor. You have to match this spend. It has to be spent on players, has to be spent on incoming players, not necessarily the current players being rewarded for their salary. So there's a bunch of adjustments that need to be made, but coming back to it, I feel for Everton. I feel for the current players. I have very little sympathy for those that knew in charge that they were pushing themselves up against the window. The idea of leveraging future money without cash in hand was always a concern with how this looks. And I don't know if 777 is the right group, if they have the right money, if they are as clean and can pass whatever these new regulations look like. I still have my own issues with having an auditor or a regulator with regards to the Premier League, but I agree with you in terms of momentum. This could be the perfect setup for years to come.
And to your point, they are looking already at changing profitability and sustainability to what you were saying there, luxury tax or something else. So it'll feel even more frustrating.
America's coming for you. America's coming for you.
Well, they own half the clubs and our country isn't worth anymore. Sorry, Tim. So buy what you want. We got nothing. We got nothing anymore. Cheers, Nigel. Listen, two other stories I wanted to quickly get your view on before Heroes and Villains for this week. And one quote from Gabby Jesus I wanted to bring you because I thought it was really interesting, this. So Gabby Jesus had knee surgery, which kept him out of Brazil's World Cup campaign in December 22. He missed 99 days of action. 15 league starts this season, trying to kind of come back from that. Three further knee injuries have happened to him in around about a year to 18 months. And he made an interesting quote this week. I think it's to the BBC. He said, quote, "I don't remember the last time I played football without pain. I just try to keep strong in my mind. The job for me is to train hard and improve what I can improve. And we'll see where we go from there," to paraphrase the second bit. But the first bit is really interesting. "I don't remember the last time I played football without pain." Yeah. 27, Gabriel Jesus. So one would hope he would have 5 years, maybe 8 years in his career moving forward. Potentially not with the injuries he's had, but just on the age range of players' careers now. Daniel, a word from you, considering, you know, you had your hip surgery recently, on how many players are playing the majority of their career with serious pain? And is that underreported? Does it matter so much if the clubs then take care of those medical situations afterwards? Tell us a bit about your thoughts on what Gabby Jesus had to say.
Yeah, my career ended at 29 because of a broken back. My L4, L5. I'm between 25 and 75% out at all times. And actually, having the hip surgery, because I was carrying my weight more on my left, I've actually come back and now I have the back pain again. Which is a byproduct. I've solved the hip problem, but I've gone back to the back problem, which caused the hip problem, which was my concern. I can manipulate my back and pop it back in place and feel the nice, cool, soothing motion of everything releasing down my right leg. But it was something that, coming back from Europe and playing in Major League Soccer and playing on the artificial surface up at the University of Utah for Real Salt Lake before they built their own soccer-specific stadium, I went down. I had a meniscus surgery in November of 2004, December, my very first day back training with the LA Galaxy just to get some fitness, I stepped into effectively what was a gopher hole, broke my fifth metatarsal, had to have a screw put in my foot. So then I was out until probably late January, which then, because I hadn't trained enough and I had no more meniscus, then I had bone on bone bruising. The very first game I played at home, I scored the diving header, ripped my left labrum in my shoulder. So I couldn't raise my arm past like this far. Halfway through the season, I kicked the post in frustration, broke the screw inside my foot, played on that for the rest of the season. Then the back got progressively worse, got traded down to LA. And by that point, I was waking up in the morning. I couldn't feel like I could stand up straight. Like I was kind of like my body was like protecting itself and muscles were tightening up. So I felt like I was curling up a little bit. So then I'm just focusing on my back to make sure that I'm healthy enough to train. But in the rush of having bone taken out of my hip to fix my foot, I had to get back on the field because there was a managerial change in the offseason. So I had to prove to the new manager the reason why I was there. The reason why I'm telling you all this, Rennie, is that I would say half of the players, especially halfway through the season, are dealing not with fatigue. They're dealing with managing injury. Managing the fatigue and the rest and the recuperation is one thing, but you're managing the pain associated with ankles, taping ankles, the how tight do you tape your ankles, dealing with knee pain. The dirty little secret is that a majority of the players are taking, I would suggest, the medical direction and doing everything they can, including some type of anti-inflammatory, and then self-medicating. I was doing all of that and adding Aleve and adding Tylenol to the point where when I retired, I made sure that I immediately had my liver tested because I was self-medicating so hard to make sure I could play because I didn't want to lose the game. So when I hear this from Gabby Jesus, there's two things that concern me. Number one, how is he taking care of himself? Arsenal is going to do everything in their power to make sure that he is taken care of because he's a physical financial asset as well as a player. And then becomes the trust factor of the medical staff talking with Edu and Mikel Arteta about where he's at. And the reality is how quickly they need to execute in the market. So these will all be subsequent plans of an announcement like this, which is him telling his story, him telling his truth publicly, but something that he's already probably talked about to the training staff and the athletic staff and strength and conditioning staff, which will then trickle back to the manager and being as open and honest as possible. But yeah, that's why the guys like Pepe are and Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi and even Luis Suarez, even though he talks about his knee and has a visible limp, are the outliers. Because a majority of athletes, we talked, you know, about players whose careers ended earlier. Once you get to 27, 28, 29, if you've had major injuries previous, you are managing those injuries. If you are then having those injuries and it's new to you, then you're psychologically and physically managing those injuries because you're thinking about now you're at the end of your career. Now there's only so much more time. There's only so many more contracts. So it's psychologically devastating. Psychologically, I just had a conversation with a current player in the last 2 weeks that's talking about him feeling like this was the first time he'd ever been injured. It was a long-term injury, and he felt like the game was taken away from him. And psychologically, he couldn't figure out a way to repair himself for every single day's action outside of soccer. And the thought and the idea that soccer was taken away from him, it's the dirtiest little secret for any athlete is when you take away that last paycheck, it's the re-identification process of who you are. You're not a doctor. You're not a lawyer. You have no long-term options. You are now no longer, for example, I was no longer Brian Dunseth, the soccer player. I was just Brian Dunseth. And then how do you reestablish who you are, your own singular identity? By the way, how do you provide for your family? How do you figure out how you're going to earn money going forward? How do your friends then say, how do you say to your friends, like to my friends, like, yeah, dude, I'm like, this fucking sucks. I'm struggling. Sorry, Tim. And then saying like, dude, shut up. Dude, you made it. Like I went to college. Like I had to get a job. Dude, you got to go travel around the world. You got to go to the Olympics. You got to play in the Rose Bowl. And then you're like, oh, well, I can't talk about that. Sorry, Tim. And then you kind of tuck in a little bit more. So all of these things are very healthy concerns, but concerns nonetheless that athletes don't ever talk about unless they're prompted to. And that's very, very rare in today's sports.
Yeah. So really interesting what Gabriel Jesus had to say. And I'm sure there are many, many, many players who are thinking about, you know, got to make sure I get the next contract. Yeah. And if you are thinking that, you don't have to talk about your injuries publicly, which makes it really interesting. Listen, more on that as we get it. I think it's a really fascinating story and something we'll talk about at further length another time. But we have to get to heroes and villains now on Week in the Tackle. We pick our hero and villain from the past week in football and explain why they think or we think they should win it. Danny, hero. Let's start with heroes of the week this week. Who's your hero and why?
I'm going to just do it to wind you up. I'm going to say Kobe Mainoo with that incredible goal, that incredible pivot, seeing Jurgen Klopp with the mouth on dash. Cut the fucking ball down. Good fucking why you're daring. Sorry, Tim. That was brilliant. I don't know why he was English. That turn, that pivot, that far post, that goal, his first at Old Trafford against Liverpool, hometown kid. I just thought it was an incredible display on top of he's been alongside Garnacho and maybe McTominay to an extent when you talk about spirit within the team despite horrible performances. Those two, Garnacho and Mainoo in particular, bright spot and otherwise really shitty season. Do I have to say sorry, Tim, on that one? So I said it. I'm not going to say it again. I refuse. So that's my hero only because I wanted to wind you up.
Good. I'm glad you're putting effort into the show. I would say my hero of the week is a bit weird.
This is the guy in a stag do all weekend long that probably couldn't even remember who won the game for the game that he actually watched.
Hey, I remember VAR disallowing, quite rightly, Wolverhampton Wanderers late equaliser.
Oh, it's going to be mine. Oh.
And well, it's not mine yet, so you can have it. But I do remember watching it in a bar with a bunch of people who did not give a toss and celebrating on Pink Street in Lisbon. So, you know. Yeah. My hero this week is Graham Potter. Now, Graham Potter this week has reportedly, so says Sky Sports, turned down the chance to become the next coach of Ajax. Graham Potter was in charge of Chelsea for 31 games before being sacked in April 2023. Now, I don't know this, by the way. So this might be, this is just pure speculation. So don't at me, don't sue me. It's pure speculation. But I bet his payoff at Chelsea was fucking huge. Sorry, Tim. Considering they brought him in from Brighton, they essentially humiliated him on a weekly basis and sacked him before he could even see out the season as manager of Chelsea. Chelsea then brought in Frank Lampard. I think that went well. I can't remember. And then it looks like, from my information, are going to sack Maurizio Pochettino, maybe even before this season finishes, because there's a managerial merry-go-round going on right now, and Chelsea do not want to be left holding the bag when everyone else is sitting down. So I'm led to believe they might make a decision on that sooner rather than later.
Can you imagine? It'd be so funny.
We will.
I can't wait.
Definitely pull the siren for an emergency week in the tackle when that happens, and it'll just be 45 minutes of overlapping laughter. But Graham Potter, he's had a few offers, and we've been speaking a lot about what's he going to do. Man United, he was linked to. Newcastle, he was linked to. This week, it's Ajax, who he has reportedly turned down a chance to take over. And I just love this because there's obviously strings attached to any person getting sacked. And you, if you stay unemployed for X amount of time, you probably get X amount of money, like an alimony payment to an ex-wife or something. And I love the fact that Graham Potter, I think he'd love to get a job. This is a man who spent years building slowly a reputation from Sweden into Swansea, into Brighton, into Chelsea to become a Champions League manager. Built a brilliant reputation. He wants to work in football, but I bet you any money he wants to stick two fingers up whenever he possibly can to Chelsea Football Club for selling him this narrative of coming to Chelsea and rebuild us from where we are now to where we want to be. And he kept saying project, project, project. And in the end, they sacked him because it wasn't going any better than it is now, right, by the way, a year ago. And I just think he got a call from Ajax and thought, if I go to Ajax right now, and again, I don't know this, but I feel like it's true. And this way he's my hero. He was like, if I go to Ajax right now, I get to be in charge of a rebuild of one of the great clubs of European football fallen on hard times. Brilliant for me. However, Chelsea, right? Sorry, Tim. I want every penny they owe me for the international embarrassment they handed me. And I want them to give me every single penny of all the payoffs I'm owed. And I just wonder if this theory will be proved right when we get to the end of April, when it's been over a year, or maybe we get to close season this season and he takes an offer that's been put on his desk because he's like, okay, I've got all the money I can out of Chelsea now. I'm ready to come back to work. And I think that's heroic stuff to take as much money out of this game as possible, especially when you've been humiliated.
Well, remember, we were teasing about Abramovich and how much money he had paid off in terms of Sachs staffs over the years. And Bolly, Igbali, and Clearlake are in the same conversation. By the way, I know you brought up Ajax. I've got a manager for you I'd be willing to offer if interested. Just saying, maybe a former manager, help him get back on track.
To be fair, I do think Erik ten Hag's better suited to a mid-table team. But he's certainly done whatever he can to make Manchester United one. Anyway, on to villains of the week. Danny, who's your villain?
I'm going to go with Gary O'Neill. I'm going to go with your boy. I'm going to go with the Wolves manager because I can't wait to see what the actual fine is if you guys do indeed do fines over in the Premier League for the verbal sparring and terrorism he brought to the table with regards to the VAR. He was bang out of order. And I love how he tried to bring down David Moyes and Lucas Fabianski with him and say, like, even they agree with me. And David Moyes like, I didn't say that. I nodded like a tough game. And I didn't say anything about the VAR. Listen, the best part about this is if that goal would have been given and it was on the opposite foot, if that was West Ham given that goal, Gary O'Neill would have lost the plot. He would have said celebratory. We probably wouldn't have deserved that. And then blah, blah, blah. So for him to argue that that goal could have stood is so comical to me. I would say, and I've been banging this drum forever, a player in an offside position anywhere between the posts is drawing the attention of the goalkeeper. Whether it means to or not, the sight line, if he's above him, if he's shorter than him, if he's on the side, if he's this side, he has to take into a context the positioning of the attacking player in a bang bang moment, whether it's a header, it's a deflected shot, all of those things come into play. The law of the game was executed correctly. I don't give a flying toss if Fabianski's 2 inches taller than the attacking player. The reality is he's directly in front of him. A player has to take into context his positioning with a reaction type of situation. I thought it was comical that he tried to say that anybody with football knowledge should say that goal has stand. He certainly would have not been saying it had the shoe been on the other foot. And they would have been in the situation. Same situation, I mean, defensively.
I always say this because I try not to be biased because of people I like, but I have worked with Gary a few times over the years, and I do think he's a good analyst and a really good guy, and Sean Derry worked with us, I mean, this season, the assistant manager, so I am a bit biased because I like them both, and yeah. I want them to do well because, you know, it's great to know a Premier League manager. It's quite cool, and they're good guys, and I wish them well, but I do have some sympathy only because the amount of time Wolves have been screwed over this season with diabolical VAR decisions, time and time and time and time again. And we've all experienced it a few times. You know, I did the Calvin Phillips thing a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure you could do about 10 Man U examples. You know, Everyone's got a few where decisions are quite clearly wrong. There was the apology thing at the start of the season. But I do think, on average,
I forgot about that.
The Howard Webb apology tour. I do think probably Wolves have had the toughest amount of bad decisions.
I would agree with that.
It's a shame that Gary went so hard on one where he was wrong.
Yeah.
Because
out of all of them, don't die on that hill.
This was not the hill to die on because I think his player was offside standing in front of Fabianski. This seemed pretty cut and dry that he was offside, and it's the player's fault for not getting back onside because Fabianski wasn't going to save that. That was the player's fault for denying Kilman, not the referee's fault. However, so many times they have been screwed this season, so I did have some sympathy for him there, but not on this one. So I'd struggle to make him villain of the week because I want him to talk to me again. My villain is a pair of Serbian crime detectives from the 90s, I assume. Muric and Grbic. It just feels like Muric and Grbic would have been the top television program in Yugoslavia in 1983. Solving crimes as the Soviet Union fell.
Wearing leather jackets and unfiltered reds. Muric and Grbic.
Yeah, it's just thick leather. Just everyone's in thick leather. anyway, and the reason I keep thinking about Marić and Grbić is because on Thursday last week, Grbić is in goal for Sheffield United, and they're playing pretty well at Anfield. And the goalkeeper looks up, sees Darwin Núñez running at him, and he's like, ah, screw it, kick it anyway. Kicks it straight against Darwin Núñez, and the ball spins in. Now, again, I'm not totally against playing out from the back because I think there are lots of solid reasons to play the ball out from the back, to draw the opposition on, for there to be space in behind, to clip it into, all of that sort of stuff. So I think doing it well, to a degree, the case has been proved. I don't think you should do it if you're Sheffield bloody United at Anfield at 0-0. But, you know, he tried it, Grbić. And in the end, it wasn't a good. And then we go to Goodison at the weekend in another feature game. And it's huge. Everton-Burnley. Everton not won in 14. Burnley with a win. And with the points deduction, I think would have either gone above or very close to Everton. So it's a huge game. And Marić, who's in for Trafford in goal, sees Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who's not scored from open play since the dawn of time, running at him. And he's like, I could pass left. I could pass right. Screw it. I'll just kick it. But he waits and waits and waits until Calvert-Lewin closed him down. And the reason he's waiting is he's trying to pick out a pass. And the reason they're villains is they cost both their teams at critical moments in their game with stupid decisions. And again, playing it out of the back, absolutely fine. Do it if you can make it work. Make a case for it. Execute it properly like professionals. Great. But if you're the goalkeeper and you know you can't do it and you know you've missed the pass, don't just close your eyes and hope for the best when a tall striker with a ponytail is running at you. Plonkers cost both their teams, and there's a reason Sheffield United and Burnley are going down, not just because of the lack of investment in the squad in its entirety, but also Yugoslavia's finest detective pairing of the 1990s. Oh, done. You need a couple of maverick cops here to deal with this situation. Chris Wilder's lost his ham sandwich. Who do we call? Marić and Grbić. So there you go.
So by the way, you used plonkers. Are they the plonkers or were the decisions on the passes the plonkers?
I would suggest both individuals are plonkers, and the concept of asking these fine 80s detectives to do
they plonked
this particular role is a total plonking. There we go. Those are my villains. Do we pick a winner? I think we don't, do we? Do we? No. Do you want to pick a winner? You're the celebrity.
They're all solid.
Here.
They're all solid. Yeah.
Let's go with mine then. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
All right, fine. That's Week in the Tackle for this week. We're going to do another show next week. If you're watching the show on Spotify or YouTube, hello, do you like my new camera? Watch me move. You can also listen to the program as a podcast on all the good podcast platforms. And if you are listening as a podcast, you can watch the show on YouTube or Spotify. That is Brian Dunny-Dunseth. I'm Tom Rennie. Tim Horsey produced the program. Another Week in the Tackle next week.